everybody. Let's redo that.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, everybody. This is Jeff Benson. I am in the Fangamer office once again with Charlie. Charlie, say hello.
Hello.
That's my roommate, Charlie. He killed a cockroach last night in our bathroom. He's really proud of himself. And I'm also here with Ben the Man Ben again.
Ben the Man Ben, hello.
And our special guest host, Elliot Ridgway, who you know from Ridgway Films and a previous podcast in which we talked about
video game
movies.
Hello.
I wasn't invited to that podcast.
What?
I wasn't invited to that podcast.
Yeah, you were. You just left.
Yeah, you just bounced. I mean, you watched Uwe Boll on your own and then just left. So you did it for basically your enjoyment, is what you're saying?
I guess.
What you're saying is you love Uwe Boll.
I was so over that I didn't even want to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, you were just too afraid that we were going to say bad things about the films, so you couldn't be here for that.
Charlie thought it was much more interesting to drive across the country than talk about a Boll film.
How would you ever think something like that?
I don't know. One's more expensive than the other, but what are you going to do?
Yeah, in the end, driving across the country was the cheaper option.
Yeah.
So, and cost of soul anyway.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. I mean, I guess when you're on your deathbed looking back at what you've accomplished in your life, a Boll film won't cross your mind, but that time you drove across the country, I think we found a healthy alternative to recommend to our audience of what they
should
do.
Instead of listening to our podcast, drive across the country.
If you think you're gonna have to watch a Boll film, or you've talked about watching a Boll film,
just escape.
Stop. Talk about, think about it. And drive across the country instead.
Yeah. It'll clear your head. And by the time you get back, you'll have forgotten all about it.
Learn from Charlie's mistake here.
Yeah.
Don't actually watch it before you leave. Anyway. What's been going on, guys?
Yeah. Charlie, what have you been up to besides smashing cockroaches?
Well, last night we watched Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Ooh.
Yeah. Ooh, that's a classic.
Yeah. It is.
It's been a while since I'd watched it. I didn't realize how funny it was. Because last time I watched it just scared the crap out of me. So,
and for good reason.
Yeah, it's a very frightening film. But now that I'm older and I can handle scary clowns, I can see the humor in all the other parts.
Did you get spooked?
Not this time.
You done goofed.
You done goofed. Don't get spooked.
Pee-wee's Big Adventure has always been one of my favorite movies. Definitely my top Tim Burton movie, alongside with Ed Wood.
I honestly don't think I've seen the entire thing.
Big Adventure?
I'll have to watch it and then have a third podcast in the row where we talk about Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
You know, we've been kind of going with this whole thing of just talking about the same topics for about three shows. I don't know if this is how it worked.
Kind of, yeah, actually. Okay.
Well, then we're really succeeding here. But at any rate, I hadn't seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure in a long time either. And we were just talking over the weekend, Charlie and myself, about three-dimensional characters and just how to write something like that. And watching Pee-wee's Big Adventure, he's kind of a character you don't think too much about beyond being this
wacky grown-up kid.
Right. Somebody who is just generally funny to watch. But they do a very good job at painting a world where he's kind of an outcast to everybody. He doesn't really know how to communicate with people too effectively.
But whenever he does, he generally makes very good friends with them for some reason. Yeah. Just the most abnormal people. he connects with.
Right. The magic store owner.
The hobo.
Right.
The bikers.
Right. And these are all people who are outcasts in their own right.
Right.
So it's just a really well-crafted film. And I think it's got Tim Burton all over it. He's in more recent years, as we've said before, kind of become more of a stylized spectacle rather than, hey, that guy's really good at telling stories. But anyway.
Fangamer Podcast, keeping Pee-wee's Big Adventure discussion alive.
If anybody hasn't watched it, I'd recommend it. Especially you, Ben, if you haven't seen the whole thing.
Yeah, I gotta. Gotta.
Gotta. What else, Charlie? What else you've been dealing with?
We finished off season two of Game of Thrones.
Ben and Elliot, have you guys watched Game of Thrones?
No, I haven't gotten around to it yet.
as I've complained in previous podcasts, it's not available to me in any way that's not massively inconvenient, so no.
Massively inconvenient or illegal.
I mean, that is sort of inconvenient in and of itself, though.
In the moral sense, yes.
Yeah, you just have to go out of your way to, like, find a torrent that's good quality or that's complete. It's just a hassle.
Yeah.
It's dumb.
Well, why won't you let us watch your show, HBO?
Aside from the availability, it's a good show.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. Have we really discussed it before on the podcast? I don't remember.
I don't think so, no.
Well, there was plenty of Game of Thrones podcasts or discussion in previous iterations of the podcast with Liz Kelly, rest in peace.
I think she talked a lot about the books more than the show, though, which it's the TV adaptation is its own story in many ways.
Yeah, I haven't read the books, but you have, Charlie.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting way to watch it, because you'll say sometimes how, well, that didn't happen in the book, or they did this differently, which is very cool, because they're taking a lot of time to adapt this whole series of books. And how many books are there?
Currently 5.
And so, in theory, they're probably going to have about 5 seasons, if they can get the funding for it. I'm assuming they can, because it's a very big, popular show.
Actually, the next book adaptation is going to be split up into 2 seasons, so...
Oh, yeah, so it could be up to 6.
Yeah.
Or even more.
Wow. Plus the ones that are coming out.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, good show. Had a pretty big ending. I hope that the White Walkers join up with some humans and decide to create a little culture called White Walker humans. By the way, that's not spoiling anything, because the whole series kicks off with White Walkers.
Yeah, you immediately realize that White Walkers, they're bad.
Yeah.
They're going to kill you.
Yeah.
And then you're going to come back and kill other people.
As one of the White Walkers, yes. The zombies of the snow.
Everything else I've been doing was, I picked up Mario Picross again for some reason. I realized that there was an easy mode that I skipped right on over, and like, well, let's see how fast I can do this. Turns out, pretty fast.
Oh, no wonder you caught up to me so quick.
And then, I spent some time with the time trials, which doesn't let you know if you've got something actually right or not. And, I've beaten it enough times to where I got all of the top scores on my own game, which it sets like a few standard ones. So and it gives you a completely new one. 100%
complete with Mario's Picross.
Yeah, pretty much. But but the cool thing about the time trials is that it keeps giving you more to do. It keeps being not only random but new ones that you hadn't done before.
Okay.
So it's I don't know when I'm going to start seeing repetition, but I haven't yet.
Well, that's cool. It's good that there's still life in that. Although, like, do you have any interest in somehow acquiring the second game for some other medium?
Maybe, but I don't know. The convenience of having it on the nice
handheld
and the virtual console is pretty nice.
Well, Elliot, I recently saw that you guys have pretty much wrapped the 7th episode of Earthbound.
Yes, that's correct. We just last night we finished filming the very last scene of the episode. So, except for pickups, we're pretty much complete with the entire series now.
How long until we're able to see all this footage? Because you guys went all the way up to Gygus and the epilogue and all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, the 6th episode, which is the one right before everything at the end of the game, that's still about halfway finished in terms of, like, visual effects and post-production and all that stuff. So I've got to take care of that first. That'll probably be around Christmas. I'm imagining I can finish it by Christmas, which means I won't be able to start working on the actual final episode till next year.
Oh, yikes.
Dang.
It's hard to fit all that in, man.
So but... I've got to, and it kills me because all the footage, you know, is amazing, and I want to start editing the episode right now, but I can't because I'm just going to have to sit on it because I don't have the hard drive space to work on 2 episodes at the same time.
But yeah, so you have all the footage that you're going to be sitting on for a long time. And I know the feeling, because you get a lot of footage done, and then you wind up sitting on it, and then you go back and look at it, and you start seeing a bunch of flaws.
Yeah.
So I hope that doesn't happen to you.
I mean, it's sort of unavoidable, like, when you're a person creating things, for that to happen anyway. Like, I was actually just talking to Calvin Hansen of Starship Amazing and Nothing Matters podcast on Twitter, and he was talking about how he was listening to my record a lot. And I was like, well, I hope you don't listen to it so much that you start to hear all like the imperfections that I do every time I listen to it. And his response was like, most of the mess ups you perceive is the distance between what you ideally wanted to make and what you released. And listeners or viewers, the people you actually released to, they don't hear that by and large because they only have access to the version they released. And that's all they know. So, right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think that is really true in general. Like, you see a lot of imperfections that other people don't see just because you have it fixed in your mind one way, the way it should be.
Yeah, it's not so much an imperfection more than it is just a dissonance between what you thought it was going to be and what it is.
But at any rate, I can't wait to see your whole series come to a close because... Yeah,
man. He's tired of your series.
I'm so tired of your series. No, I've been watching it for so long, and I've just I've seen it grow, and I feel like I have a connection with your guys' series that some people have with mine. Mm-hmm. So it's been very fun to just watch you guys progress as filmmakers and also as just artists in general, because you guys have so much visual effects that you have to do for the series.
Mm-hmm.
You filmed a lot of stuff on a green screen for this last episode.
We did, yeah. Pretty much everything for Magic Ant was on a green screen, except for a few scenes. And pretty much everything after the, like right before the Gygas fight starts up until that fight ends, that's all green screened. So there's going to be quite a bit of visual effects work to be done.
So, well, tell us something juicy about the episode, Elliot. Give us something to gnaw on.
Get us hype, man. Get us hype.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of something I could tell you that's not going to spoil something. Okay. So we did decide to take some artistic license with the ending of the game. We did change it a bit, but it should still be, like, recognizable to fans, so people aren't going to, like, complain, well, they changed the ending, I can't believe those guys. But in the sixth episode and the last episode, we make Ness's dad quite an important plot point. So I don't want to spoil how the episode ends, but there is a possibility that Ness may actually come face-to-face with his dad at some point in the episode. Ooh.
Whoa.
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
That is cool.
Getting hype. Getting so hype. Question now, does Gygas turn out to be a fobby?
No, I'm sorry, Ben.
Oh, okay. Good. Good. I have the market cornered on that.
Okay, good.
Is that how fobbies are born, Andy?
Yeah.
Honestly, yes, and like I was about to say it's a lot less stupid than it sounds, and it really isn't. But it
really
sort of is.
Isn't not as stupid as it sounds, or really isn't as stupid as it sounds?
You know, I'm just going to leave it as ambiguous as it was. Because I like to think that we made something really stupid into something sort of intense and cool. But at the end of the day, Gygas was still a fobby. So I'm just going to put that out there.
I was completely taken in with the last episode of Fobbies Are Boring. Like, I mean, yeah, thanks, man. I started off... Like, when I got, started on the first episode, I thought, man, this is kind of silly. I don't know if I want to listen to the whole thing. But the more I listened to, the more, like, I got sold on the series until, like, by the last episode, I was, like, completely, like, impressed with what you guys did with, especially, like, how you had the narrator show up at the end. Like, I didn't see that coming, like, at all.
Yeah, it was basically us just trying to justify, it's like a big apology for this awful series we created. It's like, okay, somehow we're going to make all this cool. In the end,
like,
it's going to be
Bull.
Awesome. Yeah, except I liked it, well, no, I don't think we did any better than he did. Let's be real. Fives Are Boring is the Uwe Boll film of the Earthbound.
Of the radio
fandom, really. Yeah. Yes.
Am I the only person on this podcast who did not attempt to adapt Earthbound to some other medium?
Yeah, you did.
You done fan fiction?
Oh, yeah, well, that doesn't count.
Yeah,
yes, it does.
It's not telling a story.
You wrote fan
fiction. If it was a comic, I'd be telling
a story. Are you
kidding
me? Good art can tell a story. That's what this whole
podcast
is. Right,
well, mine never did. So.
Yeah, it did. You had the one of Tony looking out at Snow White.
All right, shut up.
Hey, I'm just saying, if a guy's looking out a window at his friend who just left him, there's a story to be told there.
Yeah, I agree. That's why. Maybe you have a point, so stop talking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ben.
Yeah.
Ben the man, Ben.
Ben me.
just got back from one of the biggest cosplaying conventions, Jumbo Time.
Yeah, I spent my last weekend at Otakon in Baltimore, Maryland. It's I think it's the biggest anime con in the U.S. That might be wrong, but either way, that happened. I'm not a big anime con guy. Like, my jams are like PAX and MAGFest and stuff like that, much more to the video game extent of it. I like anime a lot, but anime cons just haven't been my jam. The reason I went was because I was helping out my friend Carlson. He runs a booth called Mad Gear. He sells used video games. He has quite the collection. I'll put a link to his site in the show notes. And so, I went to help him out. And halfway through, like, after the first day, like, I spent the entire day at that booth working. But then night happened, and, like, I started to hang out with my friends and, like, do stuff. And I had a conflict of interest at that point. It's like, there's some fun to be had at this here anime convention. And so I had to weigh between partying and not being completely messed up for work the next day. And the former, I think the first night won pretty handily. Because I met up with my friend Skew of Midnight Snacks. It's a radio show on the internet. You might know him as WT Snacks. And that guy parties hard.
And, something about a guy named Skew sounds like he would party pretty hard.
Yeah, he was wearing a David Sebe I'm Fat Let's Party t-shirt. I mean, that's pretty much, that's a dead giveaway. But no, he just, I party hopped with him, stayed up way too late, and had to work the next day. It was pretty fierce.
But now, that sounds pretty rock and roll.
Yeah, but aside from that, there was just anime things to do, like listen to people sing anime theme songs and stuff like that. You know, see some film screenings, which was interesting. Go to raves that you didn't really want to go to, but then once you were there with all your friends who were also sort of skeptical, it became fun. Like, because we rolled in and we were like, this is going to be stupid, we're going to leave in 2 minutes, it's going to smell awful. That last part was completely true. It smelled miserable. But when you have people, like, going in and fake hyping that they're having fun, that eventually turns into real fun. So, like, we just had a group of people just, like, getting really excited and hyped for this bad dubstep cover of, like, the Gotye song. And it was good. It was a good time. Apart from that,
That kind of reminds me of the Super Soul Brothers show that Charlie and I went to back in May.
Yeah.
Where there was two guests who came up and the band was taking a break. They were these two bronies that did, what would you guys call it?
I don't know. It was some sort of rave-ish music.
It like started dubstep, off as probably. Video game music and then it just turned into like a generic rave thing.
Right.
Sure.
And they get up on the microphone and they're like, how's everybody doing tonight? You know, they're really trying to get everybody excited. But this taco shop, you know, there's about 10 people in there. And they all are, you know, our friends. And so...
Yeah.
Expecting soul music.
Exactly. Yeah. So they get up there, they do their thing, and about 80% of the audience just walks out the door.
Oh, man.
And, then we're 80% in the
of the 10 people.
Right. So we're in the back just playing with a high chair. So it was fake hype that became real fun, just as you said, Ben.
Yeah, yeah. It's cool when that happens. Like, I guess the lesson I came away with was that, like, no matter what you're doing, even if it necessarily isn't your jam, like, going into it with the right mindset can still result in a lot of fun happening.
Yeah.
And I wish I adopted that mindset a bit earlier on in the weekend. Like, I was a little bit out of it for a little while, but, like, near the end of the weekend, I was having a really good time. It was great. I did a lot of music stuff there. I brought my boombox that I bought recently, this old ghetto blaster, with a tape adapter, and just plugged my Game Boy into it and just set up in random places and played music. And, like, Kevin Chai was there, our good buddy Kevin Chai.
Oh, good.
And
it's Kevin Chai.
And me and him, we got to dance around to my jams, and he actually started singing along to some of my songs, which is the most mind-blowing thing I've never even thought to think of. Like, I didn't think my music was at a point that anyone would ever know the words to it.
Everybody knows the words to Cutie Cake, dude.
Okay, sure, but, like, he knew, like, not even, like, beyond Cutie Cake, the stuff with actual factual words. I'm like,
the things that aren't just the singles.
Yeah.
The top 40 hits of Ben Kerrigan.
The top 40 Gotyes of the Space Boyfriend universe. So that was really immensely humbling and great. And I did it again Sunday, like right as everything was wrapping up. And I have a song called I'm a Train, Let's Party. And that song stemmed from my friend asking me to write a song about a train. So I did. Like, it was basically a train. Like, the basic beat is just, like, the chugging on the tracks. It's like, shh, 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 shh. And then, like, the whole, like, melody is, like, either, like, a train gate coming down or, like, the actual horns of a train. It's a silly song and has my Game Boy shouting curse words in it eventually. It's fun. Wow. It's a lot of fun. And at some point, I was leading an actual train of people doing this stupid choo-choo dance I made up across the lobby of this convention floor. There were at least, like, 25 people in this train. And I was just, I had, like, my ghetto blaster, like, on my shoulder, just, like, strutting around this floor, just, like, weaving in between people with a line of people just doing a train dance and screaming obscenities at appropriate moments. And it was wonderful. Like, that was a dream.
What it's like to be a cult leader.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I've seen very convincing evidence that the mentality that goes into a cult is very similar to the mentality of a Congo line, which is effectively what a train line is. It's a different sort of Congo line, or Congo line, or whatever.
Okay. Okay, so yeah. I can start my own Illuminati, maybe, if I aim high enough?
Well,
I mean, I'm aiming for the stars, man. I gotta surpass the universe.
Charlie's been in a lot of cults.
I mean, I wouldn't say the Illuminati is necessarily a cult, but I feel like above cult is Illuminati. Like, just gotta aim for the stars. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or happy happyism.
Or just be happy happyism.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just be a happy happiest. I am the car painter. Changing space boyfriend. That's done. Next album, car painter. Let's do it.
Space painter.
Yeah, but something like that. Aside from Otakon, good time. I'm glad to meet some people. Good to see Kevin Chai. Good to see everybody. I've been playing this indie homebrew NES game by a gal named Party Time Hexalent called Track and Feel 2. It's, as she describes it, a glitch in rhythm game. And it's a game that's really hard to describe, but it's like...
Well, it's obviously a sequel to Track and Field.
Yeah. Just with feel instead. You're feeling instead of fielding. And you can actually play it. You can actually play it with a power pad as you would track and field. But it's kind of like this free-form visualizer game where you're also sort of manipulating the music. It's really glitchy and like just very aesthetically pleasing. It's really hard to describe. I'll post a video in the show notes, but it's a really fantastic project that I know she's been working on for a while. Like, she does visualizations for, like, chiptunes a lot. Like, she's been at Blit Festival and stuff like that. And this is basically like you're playing with, like, a real-time visualizer. Or, like, you're making visuals on the spot for this music that you're also somehow weirdly creating.
That's interesting.
And it's really cool. It's a really cool toy. You can play with it, like, on any emulator, or you can flash it to a cart and play it that way. It's great. I would recommend everyone check it out.
It sounds cool.
That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
So is that kind of like the visual component to the chiptunes?
It's kind of like a hybrid of... Well, if you've ever gone to a chip performance, which I don't think you have, but basically, like, it's undeniably boring to sit someone... Or to see someone just, like, press play on a Game Boy and, like, pump his fist. Mm-hmm. So, like, there is... Actually, I can go back even further than this. Like, chiptunes sort of stemmed from this scene called, like, the demo scene... Where if you've ever, like, back in the day, like, pirated software or something, there's always, like, this crazy, like, cool music with, like, sweet visualizations, and that all came out of, like, this desire for, like, bored hacker kids to push really cool stuff out of really old hardware. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's sort of where chiptunes came from as well, where, like, people wanted to make music that wasn't, like, supposed to be made on this hardware, and they were also making, like, visual aspects to go with that. Or, like, you can make, like, these cool 3D effects on, like, an old, like, Amiga or NES or something like that that really had no business being made on that, but it was just what they wanted to do on it, and it was more so what you can do with this hardware. And that sort of split into two separate factions, that is, like, chip music and now what you go to chip music and, like, see visuals being done. That's basically the same sort of stuff. So it's, like, demo scene living on in sort of a weird way.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't been to any chiptune performances. Look forward to seeing some at some point. I know there's a music festival called Rockage in the Bay Area, where they have a lot of chiptune artists play there. It's like a 3-day festival of video game inspired music or indie bands.
Okay.
Yeah, they're actually going to be doing a pre-PAX party for those of you who are going to PAX Prime in Seattle.
Oh, all right.
I believe it's on the 30th, the day before the convention starts. It's going to be at the, I think the club's called The Asylum or something. It's like a punk rock bar.
Where?
But anyway, that check sounds... it out. Rockage. It's a, Rockage. It sounds like a cool place. Or that's a cool festival. Yeah,
that sounds cool.
Yeah. So, it was my birthday this weekend.
What? Happy birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Welcome to the 30s.
What?
Or, well, no, I'm sorry, 22.
Welcome to the
22s.
32. 32, sure.
I put makeup on. You can't tell how old. But over the weekend, I got to talk to my pops, who's doing well in Hawaii. And he told me that he just bought a GameCube that his roommate's daughter stole and put in her room.
Okay.
Because obviously he's too old to be able to enjoy
right.
these sort of video games.
Right, I know. I told him, go walk into a GameStop or something out there, because I guarantee if you walk into a GameStop and you're talking to some 20 or 30-something guy, they're going to find it pretty cool that you're into video games.
Oh, yeah, one of the coolest things I ever saw, and whenever I was working at GameStop years ago, was this old lady walks into this into my GameStop. Dragging behind her oxygen tank.
Mm-hmm.
She was desperately looking for, I think, Clock Tower 2. Because apparently she's really into survival horror games. And apparently they got her through some surgeries and some recoveries. And so she has this like, huge
same
attachment
with my dad,
to these
weirdly.
Very scary games.
That's interesting.
It was amazing.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Sounds great.
My dad was more of a Zelda and Earthbound guy. Anything that was like a first-person shooter was just too fast for him.
Mm.
But yeah, he likes Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask, and Wind Waker. Those are his favorite Zelda ones. I think he tried to do Twilight Princess, but I don't know.
A little too fast-paced.
I think he did beat it on the GameCube version. I think there was a GameCube version.
Yeah, there was.
I think he beat it on there, but... he said it was really difficult because you had to. It was adapted, of course. And you're supposed to be able to swing around the nunchuck and everything like that and do things that way. But
well, technically, it was originally designed as a GameCube game.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, they adapted it to be a Wii game.
Oh.
And then, but they released the Wii version first because they wanted to help sell the Wii.
I see.
Because it needed help.
But yeah, we just kind of hung out all weekend and watched movies. I got to watch The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which is one of my favorite films.
Ooh.
Yes, very good movie. But besides that, not a heck of a lot.
Actually, I have been playing some video games, though. I've been playing, before I left for New York, I had downloaded the new On the Rain Slick Precipice of Darkness 3, which is the Penny Arcade game, RPG.
Yeah.
And it's made by this, I don't know if it's a company or if it's just this one dude, but it's called Z-Boyd Games, where they make just classic-looking RPGs that are usually pretty short, but pretty well-compact and usually pretty pretty funny. And for a modern adaptation of an old-school RPG, it's pretty good. It's got some interesting mechanics. Like, some of the more modern things is that after every battle, all of your HP is completely recovered every time, to where you can focus each time on making each battle its own separate experience, pretty much.
Right. Hmm.
And the MP system for Rainslick is that you start off the battle with 0 MP, and every turn you gain 1, or you can use other things to gain more. So you get more powerful over the course of the battle, but then so do the enemies. So you kind of want to end battles quickly.
Hmm.
And then I with that one, since I got it like right when it came out, I also got to download two other Z-Boyd games. One of them was Breath of Death 7, and I think another one's called Cthulhu Saves the World. I haven't played Cthulhu yet, but I did play Breath of Death 7, which is this is a funny little spoof on the Dragon Warrior style games a little bit.
It almost sounds like a title parody of Breath of Fire.
And Final Fantasy and stuff like that. Yeah, like the main character is a skeleton, and everybody in the world is some sort of undead or another. Like the people who join you is one's a zombie, and another one's a vampire, and another one's a ghost. Because this is a post-apocalyptic world where all of the people were wiped out, and this is civilization being rebuilt by the undead.
Oh, wow.
And it's a really interesting, fairly short game, but it's got a lot of cool concepts to it. So I recommend it, especially since it's like just a couple bucks to download like two of the games. It's really, really cheap. So yeah,
excellent.
I've been enjoying it.
Speaking of video games, I wonder what Matt has to say about video games.
Tell us about video games.
What's up in the world of video games?
In the world is video games.
Hey now, it's Matt Hawkins, your pal from Attractmo, with yet another installment of Newsflash. Now, last week I went over, I'd say, about a month's worth of news, and about, in the end, it was like almost 20 minutes. This time around, there's only, 7 days or so worth of headlines to cover, so it should go much faster, I hope, but still, there's been a lot going on. Like, let's see, Gabe Newell. You might know him as the big boss from Valve, which, aside from being responsible for Half-Life and Left 4 Dead and Portal, is more importantly responsible for Steam, which is the top digital distribution platform for the PC. And he claims that PC gaming might actually be doomed. In a recent conference, he noted that the upcoming Windows 8 release is a quote-unquote catastrophe. It's so bad that it's going to cause massive shockwaves in the marketplace. First, top-tier PC gaming hardware manufacturers are going to get hit, but eventually, everyone from game makers to game players are just going to sort of avoid the platform. And that's why his company is looking towards Linux as a possible replacement. He says that he's basically they're hedging their bets. And assuming that, if they transpose the majority of their software, which they're in the process of doing, to this brand new platform, that they'll be able to, continue to thrive. That sounds crazy, like, seriously, who do you know uses Linux? Okay, you probably know that one crazy guy who has Linux like I do. But seriously, 20 years ago, no one was using Macintoshes, and now they're more popular than ever. I mean, it's not as popular as PCs, but, take that as what you may, but still, Stranger Things has happened and will happen in the world of video games technology. Now, speaking of digital distribution, Ubisoft's controversial Uplay system, which is their data rights management service that's universally reviled, became even more hated when it was revealed that it leaves one's computer completely open to hackers and the like. Basically, the service installs browser plugins without the consent of the user, which I think is a pretty important part, which can therefore be exploited as a backdoor. Now, almost all the major games from them are affected, and Ubisoft has since released a patch in the past 24 hours as of this recording that fixes the problems. Though, if you look online, you'll find instructions on how to disable the plugins, which is, really highly advised. You have to do it for each browser, Safari, Firefox, Chrome. If you use Internet Explorer, it's apparently pretty complicated. Again, you'll find all that information online. Again, sticking with digital distribution, GameStop, the number one retail chain for games, whose bottom line risks being destroyed by online services, has claimed that, get this, that they're investigating the possibility of selling used downloadable games. That's seriously like going to a record shop and like selling your MP3s. So how is that going to work? No one has a clue. GameStop claims that there's a method, but they're not revealing how it works, nor are they moving forward, because they say it's apparently not a marketplace worth investigating, at least for the time being. But you know what? If you're one of those people that can't stand the idea of paying a full 99 cents for a brand new copy of Angry Birds, and, just wait, because you'll soon have the chance to buy a slightly used copy for 86 cents, except it'll have the wrong icon and it'll, be sticky for some reason. Now, moving on, this is the time of year in which plenty of financial details from various game companies are revealed. And overall, it hasn't been very good for most of the major players. For example, Rockstar Games. They revealed that a considerable degree of loss took place in the past couple quarters, including disappointing sales figures. Long story short, Max Payne 3 didn't set the world on fire like they expected. They had an investors call earlier today, and basically everyone just kept calling and asking, "Yo, where's Grand Theft Auto 5?" And all they'll say is that, "Listen, it's TBA, to be announced." Though no one has it worse than Zynga. Their stock, by all accounts, is completely worthless at this point. Basically, no one is playing Facebook games anymore, and no one cares about Draw Something. Gee, big surprise, huh? But just the other day, the first of several expected lawsuits were filed, which accuses executives and those in the know of inside trading. Now, the situation is pretty complicated, but basically, top brass created a condition that allowed them to sell shares of Zynga stock while no one else could. And they did this with full knowledge that the stock was eventually going to plummet. And by the time that people were able to sell their stuff, it was too late. Like, it just lost most of its value. Again, this is actually the first of five lawsuits, and things are going to get really ugly from this point forward. And, you know, this sounds like maybe it's overdramatic, but don't be surprised if Zynga doesn't exist in the next couple of years, if not months. Moving on, you know who had it good? Capcom, believe it or not. They had a really profitable past couple quarters, and a lot of the success is based upon their Dark Souls-inspired game Dragon Dogma. So what does this mean? Basically, chances of another Mega Man game coming out before a new Dragon Dogma game is literally 30 jillion to 1. Also doing well is Nintendo, or the new 3DS XL, to be more exact. In its first 2 days of sale in Japan, it sold almost 200,000 units. I mean, that's pretty much equal on how the original 3DS did, and also how the Vita did, and that sort of bombed in Japan. So maybe that doesn't say anything, but at the very least, you know, that's good news. Also, for whatever reason, two new DSi colors are on their way to America, red and blue. Again, this is the DSi, not the 3DS, and not even the DSi XL. Sorry, you know what? I don't care. All I want to know is when the white 3DS XL is coming. And honestly, at this point, I'd just take a regular white 3DS at this point as well. Now, here's an item from a few weeks back that I forgot to say, but you know, I'll bring it up now. A lot of people are upset with EA over recent comments made about the upcoming Dead Space 3. Apparently, they said that according to their studies, players found the first two games to be too scary, hence the addition of a second player in upcoming Part 3. You know, which is pretty dumb, right? Considering the whole point of the game is that they're supposed to be scary. Now, personally, and I know a lot of people are going to get annoyed at me for saying this, but I actually blame this on Mass Effect 3. Now, the negative fan reaction from that game has seemingly caused EA to lose all confidence in itself, and they're sort of willing to do anything as long as the market research or the, you know, whoever says, you know, they should do it. But at the same time, maybe if people bitch enough, we'll finally get Mirror's Edge 2. You know, one could only hope. Now, as a follow-up for something that I mentioned last week, Square Enix has reiterated that their previously announced Final Fantasy Versus 13 is still on the way. And it'll be, you know, present at the previously announced showcase on September 1st. Though, sooner than that is the release of Final Fantasy on Android. This is the first time it's hit the Google smartphone operating system. And it too, I think this one's based on Final Fantasy 1, which is based upon the PSP remake, which is based upon the PlayStation 1 version. Got that? One more updated item. Remember the Ouya, the Android-powered crowdsourced console that, you know, I feel that has, and not only just me, has the potential to be a major player in the world of console gaming? Well, its chances have just gotten even better because it was just announced that OnLive will be supporting the platform, which is a cloud gaming service. So not only will you be able to play smartphone games on your TV, but PC games as well. And finally, two items from where I live. First, Katamari Damacy is now part of the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, at least for the time being. It's part of the brand new Century of the Child Growing Up by Design exhibit, which began on July 29th and goes until November 5th. The show is about childhood, the influence of childhood on design in art and design and architecture. And, you know, it's a good choice, right? I believe it's the only game to be part of the exhibit, which mostly contains school and children hospital architecture, furniture, and playgrounds. Though, There's also some bad news. It was recently revealed that the upcoming Tokyo Edition Blip Festival, which is the world-renowned chiptunes music festival, and it's the third one to take place in Japan, will be the last Blip Festival, at least for the foreseeable future. No real reason was given, but this is a massive blow for the New York chip scene. You know, it's always been the epicenter of 8-bit music, but Blip Festival cemented its status as the world stage that all chiptune musicians across the globe wanted to perform on, and it's going to be sorely missed. So, Ben, space boyfriend, that you know, you better make sure you get that set really polished in time for Tokyo in the next couple months. All right, that's it for me. And, you know, till next time, take it away, Jeff, Charlie, and Ben.
So our topic for this week's show is, well, Ben, why don't you say it?
The topic is narrative storytelling in games.
What does that mean?
It means we're talking about how video games tell narrative. We're talking about what it does right, what it does wrong, and if it's sort of a misunderstanding its role a little bit in some situations. Like talking about how a game can tell a story either through the writing, delivering through cutscenes, or just through gameplay. And which one is better, which one is worse, or if it all depends.
I have the definition of narrative right here, in case you need some context.
Yeah, whip it on out.
It is a representation in art of an event or story. That's simple.
Okay.
Basically, any sort of artwork that tells a story, whether it be a picture, or a movie, or a video game, or a radio play. Whatever you've got that tells a story.
Or even I don't know if any radio player ever told a story. Especially ones I've made.
And regarding that, from that definition, I'd say that video games have two distinct ways of giving a narrative. And one of those is that more objective narrative, where they're telling you a story and you're participating or not, and they're giving you a lot of information to tell that story. And then there's the more subjective ones, where they're not giving you any actual story. They're just setting you free, and you're kind of figuring out the story for yourself or interpreting it. Like Minecraft. Minecraft or Missile Command, like then that extra credits episode.
Games that are purely based on the mechanics to kind of reveal a story to you from your own
I think Journey would be another example of that, if you guys have heard or played of that.
Well, I know that Journey is definitely somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
Where it does give you some basis, like some a little bit of story, but very minimal story to set you off, but enough to where you have a little bit of a framework. But yeah, it is largely mechanics, and which is the unique way of giving a story in a video game. Like, no other medium, as far as I know, can tell a story that way.
Yeah.
Right.
But I guess when I thought of this topic, it came from a discussion I was having with Ashley Davis, where she was talking about why she didn't enjoy like Ghost Trick, Phantom Detective, or Phoenix Wright, or any of those games. It's just because, those games have even mechanical problems that were part of the discussion, but it all basically came down to how you don't have any say in how that story goes, and how it is just... Like, similarly with, Metal Gear Solid, you're just sort of along the ride.
The gameplay turns the page.
Right. Yeah, and, in the end, it doesn't benefit by being an interactive medium at all. And I'm also wondering if, games like that even have a place being games, or if they might as well have been, films or some other sort of medium.
They could definitely be interpreted in different ways, yeah. I mean... I think games are still a very fresh art form.
Yeah.
They've been around for, 40 years, really?
And we're really starting to get past the idea that, they're just toys and stuff like that, too.
Right. I mean, it's the same thing to me as saying, does this painting... Is it a justified painting, right?
Mm.
Because Target is selling a bunch of these paintings in their store as decorations.
Right.
But is it really a painting? I mean,
hmm.
Yeah, it depends on
I've
how
never thought about
it.
That.
I mean,
of course it's a painting, but I guess everything sort of serves a purpose, right? Like, you have games that are just pumped out to make money. They are those Target, like, right. home decor sort of things.
Sure. But, like, but I like Metal Gear Solid as an example, for instance. I haven't even played the game, but I know, I have a sense of what you're talking about with the gameplay turns the page and that you're really watching this story unfold in front of you, regardless of your interest to change certain aspects of it.
Yeah. It's not, and I mean, it's not even necessarily that, like, I typically don't have problems where I wish I could have, like, influenced those sort of things, because I know what I'm getting into when I play, like, a Metal Gear Solid or a Phoenix Wright. Like, it's not something I can affect myself, right. and that's fine. Like, that's why I come to those. And I've typically found games like those to, like, have the most compelling story. Mm-hmm. Like, right. There are always moments in games where, like, the narrative is self-weaving and all in the mechanics that are, like, very poignant and beautiful. But I'm not sure, like, they've ever told me a story as, like, heartrending or intense as, like, a Mother 3 or a Metal Gear Solid game. Mm-hmm. Like, there are moments in Minecraft that are capable of, like, bringing a tear to your eye. Like, I always quote, like, Anthony Birch talking about his experience, like, surviving through the night, and as he gets to the top of this mountain, like, the sun rises and, like, everyone starts to burn and this beautiful piano piece starts playing. And that cannot exist in any other medium and have it be as effective as that, because it's a part of, like, what you're doing. Like, you're absolutely invested in that because you are interacting with it.
Yeah. Like, if that happened in a movie, that's someone else who survived the night.
Yeah, it wouldn't have the same emotional impact.
In Minecraft, you survived the night.
Correct.
And,
yeah, exactly.
You've lived to see the dawn, and you can get back to work.
Yeah.
I think the difference between a game like Minecraft and a game like Metal Gear Solid or Mother 3, for instance, that Metal Gear and Mother 3, those are games that are telling you a story that you can't really go in and change too much mm-hmm. of it.
Yeah,
it's all laid out for you before you even start playing, and in that sense, I would say those are like games that you can almost take and hang up on a wall. Mm-hmm. They're there to be enjoyed for what they are,
yeah.
Not so much for the experience that they're going to give you. So it comes down to really how you use it. And that's, I guess, what I meant by the Target painting metaphor. Mm-hmm. In that, it's a painting. Yeah, if you're going to hang it up and really enjoy it for what it is, and you're going to make good use out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it just, I think it comes down to the person who's playing, if they want to actually be a part of that experience that somebody's giving to them. But otherwise, there are these other games that seem to get a much different and oftentimes much more deep reaction out of people, emotional reactions, such as Minecraft.
But, like, the similar things can be said for, like, other games that are more linear, like a Metal Gear, for instance. Like, I know, like, Phoenix Wright has always, like, hit me in a good place, and I've always, like, been able to take something like that out of that experience. And a lot of people do similar things, like, with film, that just things that you could have, like, an intimate connection with something that you're not, like, directly interacting with. And I guess, like, I'm trying to think in my mind, like, how... Well, the question that I presented, I guess, was, like, would these be better suited as, like, movies or something else? I don't think that's necessarily true, because I still have a lot of fun playing Metal Gear.
Yeah, and
it's just the method of which it tells the story, and I'm trying to think, then, like, is there a better way they could have told that story to give it, like, the same emotional impact as it has being told as is, with 45-minute cutscenes and multi, like, 20-minute codec conversations that are a chore to get through? Is there a way to tell it through mechanics and have it have that same impact? Because I don't think we're at that point in video games yet.
I think that with Metal Gear, at least with Metal Gear Solid, I remember, it seemed like the game wasn't there to tell a story. The story was there to set up the game.
Yeah.
It gave you a reason to be in this nuclear facility and around and giving you missions like that. It became very good, but I don't think that was necessarily the focus to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what I think a lot of stories end up being, or a lot of games end up being. They start off with, all right, here's the mechanics, here's the experience we want to give, and now we need a story to give us a way to get from this mechanical experience to this mechanical experience.
I think that's the case for many games, but I'm not so sure about Metal Gear. Maybe that's
there's
a problem in using Metal Gear as such a frequent example, because I know Hideo Kojima originally wanted to be like a film director. So I almost want to think that like his intent was to tell this story, but also have a game involved, because like, and if you look back to Snatcher, like that's not like bursting and like super exciting gameplay either. But like all of his games really do come down to the story first, and I really wonder what his process is, like in terms of if he plans a game first, or if he plans a story first.
Well, back to the question of, are there certain games that tell a story that could be just as effective on other mediums, particularly film? Elliot, what do you think?
Well, I just from what you guys have been talking about, I've kind of been thinking that I think that video games provide a stronger emotional experience than, say, film does, because it puts you in the driver's seat of the protagonist. Whereas when you're watching a film, like, you identify with the main character, but you're not really, like, getting that sensation of participating in those actions. Even if you are just kind of, like, going down a rail and you can't, like, change the course of the story, you still, like, have the satisfaction of performing the actions of the hero character. So I think that video games, like, in that sense, do provide, like, a stronger emotional experience, depending on how it's handled, than, like, say, a movie could.
Yeah, I agree with that, but then, like, another complaint in the camp of, like, the people who prefer games that are more mechanically driven is that you're in the driver's seat for most of the game, hopefully, but then you're taken out of it. People don't want to lose that control to the character they've been controlling this whole time.
I mean, in terms of adapting to a film?
No, not even more so, just
like...
Do you
just mean, like, going to a cutscene?
Basically,
why,
like, people play
can't
a video...
you use a Phoenix down on Eris when she dies in Final Fantasy?
Basically, well, I mean that's sort of what it boils down to, right?
Right, exactly. Like, any other point in the game, she dies, you use a Phoenix down.
Yeah, it's no big deal.
And it kind of ends up with this very the separation of where you have control and you don't. And I can see how that can kind of break you
out. It does bring you out of it, because, like, you spend the whole game, as you said, like, you do have an emotional attachment to these characters, but suddenly you don't anymore. And, like, I mean, it's kind of weird, like, it's hard to balance that, because you can't be given, complete control all the time.
It was important for her to die within
the story. Exactly. But, I mean, that, again, goes back to, would that story have been better suited to be told as a film instead?
And I don't think it necessarily would have. I think that Final Fantasy
VII
would have
been very long.
Huh?
I said it would have been a very long film.
That, and it, I don't know. I mean, it might have been good, but yeah, I don't think it could have. Whenever I've actually seen Final Fantasy movies, they don't live up to the games. Mm-hmm. They just don't. You get
spirits
more connection.
Within.
Advent Children. The way they depicted the characters in there, they were Goku and Frieza fighting each other on Namek. As far as I could, there's no difference. It wasn't just these actual these people fighting with weapons and going back and forth. It was flying around like you have no connection to gravity anymore.
I think an important distinction to make between different mediums and telling the story is that people go into it for different reasons. As I was trying to say, like, with a painting, if you're going to look at a painting, really look at a painting, you want to be in a position where you're comfortable to look at this image for a certain amount of time until you really feel like you've absorbed it and you've experienced it the way you needed to get it and however you did. And so in that sense, that's the amount of control you have when viewing a painting, but you don't get a sense of agency with it.
No.
But
that's sort of what you're doing during a cutscene.
Yeah, in a way. But I think that could appeal to a different audience of gamers, in that maybe there's a demographic of gamers that are out there that enjoy playing a game that is telling a story to them that they can at times just sit back and watch a movie occasionally.
I mean, I'm definitely one of those people. Like, I love Metal Gear Solid. I love Phoenix Wright. In which case, a lot of games that do that, like RPGs, just linear games like that.
But in which case is that creating a different medium to tell a story?
That's interesting.
Because now we're able to experience it in multiple ways. Okay, Elliot.
All right, well, rest in peace, Elliot Ridgeway.
Thank you, Elliot, for joining us on the program.
Yeah.
But back to how video games are able to tell a story through gameplay and through cutscenes.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, it is kind of creating a different way to experience and view a story instead of it being all or, you know, all one way or the other.
It's just, like, so hard to think about because, like, I'm trying to wrap my head around, like, how a story can be told otherwise. Like, how we can eventually get to the point where those people who are turned off by that control being taken away will be satisfied with a game telling a story like Mother 3, for instance.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure if there's an answer for it yet, because it is such a new medium that just keeps evolving.
Yeah.
Maybe there is. Hopefully, maybe somebody in our audience can leave us a voicemail about it.
Make that game.
But one thing I would compare it to is, like, when film came out and people were making silent movies, those were very popular. And then sound suddenly was dropped into the equation. The important thing to note here is that when you have a silent movie, you can explain purely through visual means. And visuals include text. So you can literally tell a story to somebody as opposed to having them watch, say, characters talk to each other and the story is revealed to you through their acting. So that right there is an example of two very different ways of telling a story in a medium as it was growing. So I think we're seeing the same thing here.
That is a really interesting metaphor.
And a lot of actors didn't make that transition either. That's also worth noting.
Right.
A lot of people weren't able to hold that kind of persona to have people's attention spans follow them.
Yeah. So video games, yeah, they are definitely in a transitional period. But it's just at the point now where, like, there are the games that, like, completely, like, get rid of the whole hand-holding linearity. Like, those games seem to do that by getting rid of, like, a plot so much at all. Or at least not completely, but one that is very unimportant. Like, I've been playing Far Cry 2, and that's a fun game. Like, a lot of people don't like it, but there are just, like, really cool things that happen, whether or not, like, they're serious or not. I mean, they can be or they can't be. For instance, I really enjoyed this moment where I got into, like, this main central town in Far Cry 2. I saw this purple car, and I'm like, I need to get in that car, and I want that car to be mine for the rest of my life. I fell in love with this car.
Oh, that's right.
And so I was driving it around, and unfortunately, it's in the jungle. Well, some of it is. And I accidentally hit a log and just ramp into this, like, muddy ditch, and my car is just stuck in the mud and done forever. So I had to say farewell to my beautiful, beautiful purple car. Like, days later in game time, like, I am, like, in the savannah, like, completely far away from where that car even was. Like, I'm miles and miles and miles away from anything. And suddenly this car starts to, like, drive up at me. So, like, I shoot at it because I think someone's inside. And then by the time it gets to me, it stops. And it's a purple car. And there's no one in it. And it looks really beat up, as if it had been in the mud for a very long time. And I know this is just a coincidence, but the fact that that happened, like, that tells a story in and of itself, and whether or not, that's a very silly example.
The
but
trials really, that car went to get back to its rightful owner.
Yeah, to get back to me, yes.
Not to mention, what's a car doing with such personality?
Right? Right? But no, it's just stuff like that, like the Minecraft instance. That stuff is beautiful. I know,
Yeah.
Pyro Guy pointed out some really cool subtle things that happen in, like, and a lot of Bethesda games, like he was talking about in Fallout 3, like, you can find, like, this old trashed drive-in where, like, the screen's, like, completely mangled, and, like, there's a car just in the lot still, and you can see, like, two skeletons, like, sharing an embrace on top of their car, and that just, that's something that you have to find on your own in this game. It's there for you to discover. It's nothing that the game is telling you, like, through narrative, but it's something that paints a picture in your mind that you're free to create yourself. And that is, like, stuff like that really does seem like it's exclusive only to this interactive medium. Yeah. And that stuff's beautiful. But I wish, like, games like that had more of an actual story for me to be experiencing as well. More than just world building. Like, world building is wonderful, but it takes characters interacting in that world and reacting to that world to make it truly interesting.
Yeah.
And, like, I feel like most Bethesda games, I mean, I haven't played enough of them to truly judge, but, like, most games of that caliber where it does have a beautiful world for you to, like, react with and experience, they just don't have anyone else experiencing it with you that you can relate to that are in any way lasting or interesting that you would find in, like, any other linear storytelling sort of game. And that's what I want. Like, I want that fusion to become more apparent someday.
Somebody's got to get on this.
But I don't know. I think a lot of people still do a pretty good job of, like, of telling stories and making an interactive experience out of it.
Yeah, like the system isn't broken or anything, but it has
it just has room to grow, definitely.
Yeah.
Like Phoenix Wright. I mean, I love those games. They and they have really cool stories, but the play aspect is where you're figuring out exactly what happens, and if you can come up with the correct conclusion before the game explicitly tells you what the conclusion is, then, you know, you feel pretty good, even if the game itself is going to barrel on to the same conclusion eventually all on its own. It still gives you the chance in that interactive part of figuring out the problems is still unique to video games. Even if it isn't a huge interactive experience, it's just enough.
I was going to say, even something like Mother 3 or Earthbound, in that they're interactive and that you get to kind of talk to anybody you want in this world, and they're each going to tell you something very specific to how they view the world. Mm-hmm. And little anecdotes like that, to me, that has potential to grow as well.
Yeah.
But even that much is just cool. Of like, here, go talk to people and experience life through their eyes, just for a moment, through their words.
And that really does seem like it's sort of skating that line, and that's good. Where, like, these people have personalities outside of, hey, you're going to talk to me, I'm going to tell you some hint about where you're supposed to go next or something like that. Like, they actually give you an insight to how other people react to this world you're thrown in. And at the same time, like, I would like that more if, like more, maybe more people in your party reacted to that somehow. But that also sort of gets rid of, like, sort of why Earthbound was effective, because you can sort of put yourself in it.
Yeah,
it's such a balancing act.
Yeah, it is. But this is an interesting question for RPGs, though, because in RPGs, a lot of the time, you need to have characters that will sometimes explicitly tell you, you got to go do this now, or else you're just not going to know what to do. But the way Earthbound does it in a lot of cases, it's very subtle and at times anecdotal.
Like, unless you use the hint guy.
Right, unless you're using the hint guy, in which case...
In which case, you're out $35. Yeah. I'm going to pay attention in the first place, so I already know where you're supposed to go.
And in the third place, I mean, the game comes with a player's guide. What are you doing?
there's so much text that most players miss out on in Earthbound. Yeah. It's like, the hint guy's pretty hilarious.
Yeah, he's good. He always calls you whippersnapper.
It just costs so much money.
Yeah. But, like, some of my favorite anecdotes that point you in the direction to go would be, like, in Foresight. You talk to people, and they're just generally upset about Monotoli owning so much of the city. So they're not telling you, go check out Monotoli. They're just telling you how much they hate it.
Still telling you, go check out Monotoli.
Right.
This guy is a problem, and someone needs to fix this. I don't know who.
Right.
It might be you. You don't know.
See if it's what you do, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty cool, but... Are things that way in most RPGs, or is it pretty much just that kind of style of RPG? Because Charlie and I were recently watching the extra credits explanation of the difference between JRPGs and North American RPGs.
They're more similar than you might think. It's mostly in the main characterization that they're
really different. Mm-hmm. And also in, like, the direction that they take it, especially nowadays with stuff like Fallout and all that, where they take whole different game mechanics, like being a first-person game as well as, mm-hmm. you know, that. But then, I guess it's not the first time you've had first-person games, because I remember Phantasy Star, the first one, had a lot of first-person parts. But anyway.
Like, adventuring in, like, mazes and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But it's still, the Japanese one is more focused on giving you established characters. Even the main character often has an established personality, or at least a hinted at one. And then the rest of your party is much more established. And then in Western RPGs, you're creating yourself and you're going out and exploring the world. Mm-hmm. And they are very distinct, but I think they're coming at a common problem from two different angles, and eventually, and several games I think have met somewhere in the middle where you have a more personalized experience while still having a very compelling narrative.
Right. Yeah.
Unfortunately, I can't think of a whole lot of them that I've played, but I'm certainly not complaining because I've enjoyed a lot of games that have attempted to do a lot of that.
I mean, that's sort of the reason why, like, I haven't gotten into, like, too many Western RPGs. And, like, Mass Effect, I think, actually is a pretty good example of, like, where it's, like, mixed together well, just to pick up what you were putting down, Charlie. And that, like, it is, like, this, they're approaching it differently than, like, a JRPG would, but it still has, like, this narrative, and it has, like, character development and like interactions that
and Shepard is Shepard, regardless of what you make. You determine like branching paths, but in the end, Shepard is still going to be a badass no matter what you do.
Shepard is Shepard, and I mean your party changes, but they are going to be who they are too,
right?
And that's really cool, and that's what I would like to see a lot more of. Just like I'm a big fan of like character pieces and like just character development in general. And that's something that's devoid in a lot of Western RPGs that I've been exposed to. And I mean, maybe I'm hoping or projecting what I like on many other people, because I know a lot of people love like Western RPGs and a lot of Bethesda games.
I can say that like specifically for Bethesda games, like Fallout New Vegas specifically, you get these partners who will follow you around if you want them to, and you'll experience different places, and they'll make their comments. And depending on what you do or what you help them out with, they will develop as characters. And they give you a different perspective than you would have on your own if you go through the trouble of actually having them around. Hmm. And it's up to you if you want to help them develop or if you want to ignore them. That's the beauty of that kind of game in the first place, is that you can make all these decisions and go anywhere you want and either help everybody or ignore everybody or kill everybody as you want.
That seems like so alienating, though, because like just the fact that you can do one thing that will completely change your experience from someone else's. I mean, maybe it's on me because I don't find that like super exciting.
That's a good point.
Just listening to what I just said, that sounds awesome. But at the same time, I guess I do like a little bit of hand-holding, and it just seems a little crazy that I could accidentally not get an amazing experience someone else had because I didn't talk to this one person or I didn't do this one thing that I didn't know I was supposed to do. But maybe I wasn't supposed to do that, and the way they experienced it isn't the way that everyone is supposed to experience it.
Yeah, that's really worth mentioning, too, because it really depends on what kind of stories this person really likes, you know, that's going to be playing this game. Or, like, one of the things we've been talking a lot about is Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces and the certain milestones that a character tends to go through, or a hero tends to go through, to kind of go through this journey and make a change in their life near the end, usually. And that's the thing that really makes them... The story stay with you. But some games take this, and a lot of stories in general take it, but some games have taken this, but have really just put the hero's journey into the game mechanics, less so much the story that is coming at you. It almost sounded like in a, what was it, Fallout or something, where you're able to make decisions of, I want to experience this character longer, I'm going to go off and do something else, or even Mass Effect. I can see how that, in a way, is kind of a story that has a lot of extraneous stuff going on. That's really just kind of for the personal user to make it unique to their experience. Right. Not so much you have to talk to this character because they're going to explain something about the theme that this story is revolving around. It's probably capable of it, but I don't know. How many side missions are there usually in these types of games?
It depends pretty wildly. Like Mass Effect, I mean, you have your primary goal and it'll usually branch off and you have to accomplish several things in whatever order you want, and then it comes back to another choke point.
Yeah.
And as well as just being able to just in general explore the galaxy, right, and help whatever. And then you have something like Fallout where you're pretty much tossed out into an open world, and while there are some mechanical reasons why it can railroad you for a little while, as you get more powerful, you just bust down the walls or just, you know, break free of the rails and just explore to whatever you want to.
Yeah.
I think Fallout New Vegas specifically has lots of things in place to get you to go where you're going to experience the most story as long as you're paying attention. But it's not going to force you to limit yourself.
Yeah.
I remember where I was going with that.
Well, it's a great description of what games have to offer, right?
Yeah.
Because you're really, as we were saying earlier, you're really just the driver. You can go and experience this a lot better than, say, a movie, because, like, for the escapist, for somebody who wants to get away from reality for a while, games have a much better way of introducing you to a world that you can be a part of than most other art forms out there. I can't really think of one that would kind of surpass it in the potential it has. That's exactly what's so exciting about games right now, is that a lot of people are just kind of exploring how to make a game that allows you to explore while telling you a very genuine story at the same time.
I'm kind of interested in seeing in a game like Fallout, actually watching someone go through it and actually experiencing the hero's journey naturally. Like, whenever they go out there and, like, the games always give you art, this is kind of what you're supposed to be doing. And almost immediately, whenever I start a game like that, I veer off the path as soon as I can, because I want to go explore everything else but the story. Because I'm not ready for it yet.
Right.
And eventually it's going to pull me back. And I want to see more people experience the stages just naturally, just over the course of playing the game, and in a little bit less enforced way than apparently Journey does,
right,
where it's where if you try to just go off and explore the desert, the winds push you back and don't let you go off and explore. Whereas instead, you just naturally come back all on your own. I don't know. It seems like that's obviously a very uniquely video game experience. And the fact is, whenever you're going through a hero's journey like that, it's not going to be as impactful as watching someone else do it, because you're going through it all on your own. When you don't see the changes in yourself as you go through a big experience,
right,
until you come home again, I guess. And then all of a sudden you start remembering, that's how I was like. And then maybe at the very end you'll have a very profound experience in realizing how much you've changed without realizing it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you watch a movie or you play certain video games, you see them and it tells you as you're going that,
right,
yeah, you're changing. You can watch that because you're not them.
Yeah, like Pee-wee's Big Adventure, I'll go back to that because that's a good example of a hero's journey, in that he very much wants to find this bike. It's his favorite bike in the whole world, and it's his prized possession. And he gets ferociously depressed because his bike has been stolen, to the point where you fear that you don't know what he's capable of at a certain point. He locks everybody in his basement to essentially yell at them because he's upset about his bike being stolen. And he can't get any clues from it, so now he's lost. So he's terribly depressed, and then he's told to go to the Alamo because his bike is in the basement. And suddenly he has a newfound energy of, you know, zest. Now I'm going to go out and, you know, find this bike. I can get back what's mine, and I'll be happy once again. And as he continues through his journey to get his bike back, he has to become a bit more serious. He's not the goofy child man who went running outside in the beginning after having his breakfast machine go off, and he runs outside screaming just for the hell of it, you know?
Yeah.
So, near the end of the movie, he's a bit more serious, a bit more pragmatic with what he's trying to do, and, you know, by the end, he seems to be back in a kind of a goofy state of mind, but he looks like he's grown. And I think it's because we've seen him go from very happy to very upset to very determined to accomplishing a goal. And so, yeah, you can totally see a character make a change in a movie. And I think you could in a game, of course, if you were being told about their character, less you being the character itself.
Yeah, and I guess that returns to sort of like the beginning where I was thinking, like, should that sort of, like, Charlie, you painted like an excellent picture of how, like, when you go through that journey as yourself, you don't notice the subtle changes within yourself until like a certain point, or maybe you don't at all till like the very end. And is that more what games should be aiming for, do you think?
I don't think you should. Like, I don't think they should be limited to one way or the other. I think they should be free to explore all of those avenues, because people want different things from video games. Sometimes they want to be told the story. Sometimes they want to go off and explore. Sometimes they don't want a story at all. They just want to play a puzzle or whatever.
So, of course.
I don't think there is a right answer in this regard at all. But I think there are ways that the way people have been trying to tell these stories can be improved upon, and you make better use of the game mechanics in telling the story, or make better use of a story in making the game stand out. But I don't think there's only one way to do that. And I don't think that I don't know.
That's the magical part of this medium, though. I mean, it has limitless potential, as I guess a lot of mediums have kind of experienced and still do, but in the case of games, you could create so many different types of games that appeal to so many different types of people.
Yeah.
That I think that's why it's as popular as it is and continues to become more popular. That's why 61-year-olds and ladies with oxygen tanks are coming into GameStops and saying, hey, these are cool, I like these. I watched The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly over the weekend for about 2.5 days. This is I have the director's cut, so it's 3 hours long. It's a really long movie, and usually with long movies, I like to space them out. But the reason why I do this is that I enjoy sitting down and watching a story. Mm-hmm. I enjoy sitting down and watching characters I relate to and like and feel intimate with them. I don't know if I want to meet these guys in real life, but I certainly find them compelling to watch. And so that's the reason why I'm going into this movie. If The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly was a game, I don't know if I'd play it. It doesn't sound too interesting. But the reason why I bring it up is that these different ways of telling a story, they appeal to different reasons that people have going into them.
Yeah.
Let's see. Some brief notes from the people who have posted. Ilobo started off. He says he prefers games with minimal exposition, like Journey and Ico and Shadow of the Colossus.
Mm-hmm.
And that tells a story through gameplay and visuals. And if it does have a lot of reading, he prefers it to be character-driven. So,
I think agree with that.
Yeah, which I think drives home that if he's going to get this experience, if he wants this experience where he's either just playing the game, or if he wants a story, he wants the game to sort of cater to that direction more fully, I guess.
I think he's saying he doesn't like exposition, which I think is a general rule across all mediums. Don't thrive on exposition.
That's probably a good one. Let's see. Pyro Guy pretty much disagrees with you, especially as far as Metal Gear. He doesn't say that he doesn't like Metal Gear, but he says that his method of telling a story is not very good.
Yeah, I mean, all fans of Metal Gear can say like it's a crap method of telling a story, but it's such a good story.
Yeah, whenever you spend about half an hour listening to Codex conversations. let's see. Liar, I'm just going to go ahead and read his post. Narrative storytelling is an awkward application of film vocabulary and techniques in video games, and is why Mother 3 isn't as good as Earthbound. That's not to say I don't enjoy a really good JRPG or Phoenix Wright or something. It's just that in the rush to make art, I think a lot of games end up looking like low-budget films with bad scripts.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that sort of addresses the whole conversation we had.
Yeah, but I feel that also, that's a bit generalizing. I mean, not all people who are making these games that are, you know, told that way, they have to have been influenced by other mediums besides film in terms of story, because stories have been around for so long.
Yeah. I mean, but that's probably the most common way of telling a story today, though, is through film.
Yeah, but books also exist.
No.
Actually, I remember hearing, like, from someone in the industry, it might have been an extra credits episode or something, but where they actually explained that the reason why a lot of stories are the way they are in video games is because they start off with the mechanics and they start making a game that they want, and then they pull in a writer. Mm. And the writer is most often a writer from some other medium. There aren't people who are game writers, specifically. There are novel writers, and there are film writers that they pull in, and those people work off of the ideas that they already know, whether it's not something that works well in film or in books or on TV mm-hmm. or anything like that. So it's going to feel a lot like what they're used to.
There aren't many writers that specialize in video game writing, is what you're saying.
Not yet.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll see a spark in this, because I think it's a great... It's a medium that has a lot of potential for writers.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's see. Adori had lots of notes about various subjects, to start off with, she basically said that stories are the reason she plays games at all, and that she doesn't even really consider herself a gamer. Mm-hmm. She plays games in order to see stories. So it's... This goes back into what you're expecting or what you want from a game whenever you go into it.
Yeah.
And then Chiron Redshift goes on for a bit about the Walking Dead game by Telltale, which, I mean, I haven't played any Telltale games, but I know that they're pretty much like point-and-click adventure games, I think.
Yeah. They are.
Which is a very story-driven style of game.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's a game that lends a lot to like choice as well. Like not necessarily like you can control where you're going or anything, but like little choices you can make can have huge effects later on down the line in that game. Yeah. And like that is a good example of like that sort of linear story, like being more modular, and like being more well told as a game instead of anything else.
Yeah, The Walking Dead is also as a franchise is like it's pretty heavy on the writing. Anyway, so that makes sense that their game would have a big story to it.
Yeah, going back for a second to Adori's post, like, she wrote a little bit about Star Fox 64 that I never quite thought about. And she says, I was talking to my brother earlier on how Star Fox 64's hard mode ending was a great example of video game storytelling, especially if you were low on health or had a damaged wing near the end of it. Because you were placed in the role of Fox as he was being guided by his father out of Andross's lair as it was all blowing up. And it was a touching moment as well as an anxious and an exciting one that can only be uniquely told through a game. Like, say, like, during the last fight with Andross, you're very, very low on health. You're missing both of your wings, and suddenly you have to escape from, like, this huge exploding complex. That's very easy to take the wrong turn in. And it's just a very intense moment that you're being put through that wouldn't be quite as intense or satisfying if you were just being shown it.
Right. Well... Isn't that the ending of Star Wars?
A little bit. Although, I don't know, you can't feel the same desperation, I think, whenever you're watching Lando Calrissian flying through the Death Star, and whenever you're flying through the Death Star yourself with your own broken starfighter,
right.
And just trying to make your way out before you die. You felt
every piece of damage.
Yeah, you can sympathize, and it certainly is intense, but you... there's no need to sympathize in a video game because it's happening to you.
Right.
At least in a game like that, where you're put in that sort of situation.
Well, I don't know. I just stand up and walk away.
You just walk out of Andross's lair. Runedevros just made a final comment on like how Bastion had a very unique way of telling the story, where it delivers the story in narration that happens as you're playing the game. And like, to me, I haven't played Bastion yet, so that concept, while it sounds unique, it also sounds sort of a little too convenient and maybe ham-handed a little bit, and like it might be a little easy to sort of like not realize what the dude's saying as you're trying to survive in this game, but perhaps they do it in a way that's very
pretty reserved. Okay. If he's talking a lot, then that means not a whole lot's going on in the game. Okay. You're just walking through something. Sure. Otherwise, he'll probably mention something briefly, like you start fighting this one big gator thing that, you know, goes to the ground, and he's talking about how this one thing is like the mother of all, you know, the gator things. Mm-hmm. And
gator thing how many is the technical term.
And how nobody's survived around it before, and, you know, just talks about eventually, you know, the kid defeats it, and that's telling you all this backstory about this thing that you're fighting, and then really it all amounts to nothing. You defeated this. You've just destroyed history. Congratulations.
That's really cool, though. I mean, that seems like a really good way to build a world.
It is. It really is. It tells you, it gives you information about what you're seeing around. So, I don't know. I really liked the way it told its story, but wasn't intrusive. And didn't waste your time by making you flip through lines of text while you're doing this. You're hearing the story while you're actually playing the game.
Now, is that game, like, story heavy?
Because
maybe I do need to play that game.
What's that?
Alan Wake uses the same mechanic.
It sure does.
Oh yeah.
Sometimes it can be a little cutscene-y or whatever. But
aside from the cutscenes, like when you find a page from the novel he's trying to write that he doesn't remember writing,
right?
He just reads it to you instead of it being like, all right, now I got to scroll through some pages of text. He's narrating while you're playing the game, which is kind of nice.
Mm-hmm.
No, would you consider like Bastion to have like a story just with game in it, or like a game that just has a story in it?
I think in Bastion they are incredibly intertwined.
Okay.
I it's hard for me to say that it's one or the other. With Bastion, it was obvious that they were producing both and made it fit together. I mean, I guess that's part of the beauty of it being a fairly independent game with just a few people working on it who really were very passionate about how to make a game like this.
It sounds like something I should have played before this podcast so I could have a more well-rounded opinion. But no, yeah, that was that in the Humble Indie Bundle?
It sure was.
I'm trying to think if I have that game.
You have to donate like a minimum amount, because that was one that unlocks if you donate a certain amount.
Okay, I think I did donate enough to get it then.
Yeah, there you go.
Anyway, I'll play that after Sword and Sorcery next week. Anyway.
Yeah, seriously. Geez.
Take us away.
Stop slacking.
Dance to the rhythm and the beat. Celebrate, celebrate my love.
Okay. Well, unfortunately this week we don't have any podcast voicemails.
Voicemails? It's because you hate us.
Well, it's not that you guys hate us, but you're probably too busy. Maybe you're trying to get your Fangamer merchandise back from the people who've stolen it from you. James, you haven't called us back. Also, where's Kevin Chai? He's never around anymore.
I saw him. He's not dead. I saw him, like, over 24 hours ago. Maybe
what good does that do me and Charlie?
I should have stopped him right where he was at Otakon and been like, yo,
record,
give us a voicemail.
Give us one right now.
Just call up our beeper. Yeah.
So we're not going to be doing voicemails this week, but we have a little bit of Fangamer news.
Oh, good.
Yeah. This seems to be surprising to Charlie, which is significant because, I hope he knows that he's leaving to drive to Florida tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Nerdapalooza.
Yeah.
Go down and get really hot and humid for a couple days and hang out with a bunch of nerds.
That's all you're going to do. Yeah. That's all that happens at Nerdapalooza.
Oh, it's going
to
be...
Everyone go to Nerdapalooza.
A bunch of interesting performances, I'm sure. People like the Protoman and the 1UPs and...
You should take Mustin to go get a turkey. Like get a turkey dinner. Or you should just throw a turkey up on stage. Go, man. That's what I would do.
Oh, sure.
Then I'd probably be booted out of the convention.
Yeah, I don't think they take too kindly to turkeys on the stage.
They don't take too kindly to live turkeys. What if it was roasted?
You know, what if the turkeys could gobble to the tune of Bubble Man?
It might be more acceptable in this venue.
Yeah.
In other news, Reed has been trying to help the Wonder Twins assemble their gaming computer. If anybody, for whatever reason, has been watching Reed on Twitter communicating with Mashy Soup, they're trying to build a computer in the office for them to play games on. I guess they've invested about $500 into this thing. And the graphics card failed, and they had thrown out the box for the graphics card in the dumpster behind our office.
Oh, good.
So Reed told them they're going to have to go dumpster diving for it so they can return it, since they need a totally different one.
And then he closed the lid and sealed it up, and now they're in the dump.
Yes. We have disposed of them.
Finally.
Oh, no, Mashy Twins. Yes. That was their punishment for Brian being on the podcast last week.
Apparently he received some death threats.
I don't think that's
true. I don't think it's true either, but that's his way of saying, I don't want to be on a podcast again. but anyway, the dumpster had been emptied, so they can't return their graphics card. I think that's a really funny ending.
Wait, they could?
Did they dumpster, find it? It was over the weekend, and the dumpster was emptied. So there's no box, and now they're stuck with a graphics card. They'll probably have to sell it on Craigslist or something and meet some weirdos. Like,
in peace.
Myself or Charlie.
Some real weirdos.
Yeah. Tomorrow, Charlie's leaving for Florida, and simultaneously, Melissa King's going to be coming back to
visit
and do a little bit of work and finally take care of her cats that have been living with Charlie and me.
Yeah.
Wait, really? She just left you her cats?
She just got up and left her cats here.
Why would she do that?
Well, because she knows that
we're not going to let them die.
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Well, when I got...
Jeff's not going to let them die.
Yeah, see, when I got back and I was out of town for the weekend, Charlie, I had shown him how to empty the litter box, and...
Okay, so we're making baby steps here.
And, I gave him enough information to know what he's doing, and I get back, and I'm about to head into work, and I realize, I should empty the litter box, so I open it up, and it's not just full... It is a sizable pyramid of all different types of waste. And it's all piled up about 3 inches from the ceiling of this litter box. It's like a fully enclosed thing.
Yeah. So Charlie did good.
He did real good. And then when we were coming back home that night, I asked him, did you empty the litter box when I was gone? And without missing a beat, he said, oh, no.
I've taken care of a cat for years, emptying her litter box and all that, and I'd usually change her litter about once a week. I wasn't expecting it to become, you know, Chernobyl over the course of a weekend.
It was that thing that if you look at it, you instantly die.
Yeah. It was pretty bad, but I took care of it. No thanks to you, Charlie.
Right, good.
Okay, so will she be around for next week's podcast?
I think she will, because Charlie won't be here.
Right.
So we're going to have to...
Yeah, if that's the case, I'll have to finish up Cora so we can revisit
that. Yeah, we can talk more about that business. for some actual fan gamer news here.
not about dumpsters
and cat waste. we're going to be doing a Kickstarter either next week or hopefully the week after that at latest. Charlie, you put this together, so why don't you explain it?
Well, we just want to reprint all of our older designs that we haven't been able to reprint because we were busy making new designs. And so it's going to be an opportunity for everybody who wanted to get some of the old designs that hadn't been reprinted for a while to finally get them.
Yeah. And we're asking for a reasonable goal of $20,000, which is pretty... It's significantly cheap when you look at how many different designs we're offering.
Right. And then if we hit certain goals beyond that $20,000, then we'll actually be able to get larger runs of all of them to actually get back in the store. But if we hit the $20,000, we'll be able to at least take care of everybody who has pledged in order to get specifically the designs they want for just the run.
Yeah.
Super right.
And then we have a bunch of other things. If we reach certain goals, people will get other goodies as well as their shirts and all that stuff.
So. Right. There's some really cool stuff, like... Donate a certain amount, you can go to PAX or MAGFest.
Oh, yeah, the upper level rewards. Yeah. So,
really nice stuff. I mean, even the lower level stuff's really cool, too.
Right.
You can donate, I think it's $22 for a shirt?
Yes, is it 22? Actually, I think it's... Yeah, it's 22 for a shirt.
Yeah.
And then with shipping.
80 or something like that? Or what was the combination where you get four shirts?
Oh, yeah, 80 was four shirts.
Yeah. Great deal.
It includes shipping. So.
Yeah.
And then if you want to get like six shirts, you donate at the 80 level and you just deal 20 bucks per shirt. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
and these 120 all come with packing slips and buttons and stickers.
If you get $100 worth of stuff, then you're going to get like a really cool packing slip just like normal. Yeah.
So it's essentially just like you're shopping in the store.
Except they're a little bit cheaper.
Oh, yeah.
And you're helping us out and yeah,
and other people out too, because
if something's funded,
we'll be able to restock it and have those designs in the store still.
Yeah, for posterity.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of these designs are from the very beginning of Fangamer.
Yeah, like right back to Ice Knout NP.
Right. And Psyrockin.
Yeah, Psyrockin. Well, Psyrockin, we've reprinted so many times and it still sells out. So yeah, it's obviously a big thing. And we're gonna have some Kickstarter exclusive designs.
Yes.
Stuff that's still technically reprints, like old designs that we had, we're just going to be putting them onto a shirt when they had never been on a shirt before.
And I've seen these, and you look at them, and you almost forget that you've seen them before, just because it's a fully new experience. Talking once again about medium changes. This is really cool. I like a lot of the shirts that we're going to be coming out with as bonuses. Yeah. But yeah, that's pretty much Fangamer news. Otherwise, we've been, again, shipping out Double Fine stuff, still going at that. And just keeping on trucking.
Keeping on trucking.
Now you're going to make me want to sing a song, Ben.
Okay. Play us out.
Can you sing a song with me?
Vincent Cat? What song?
I don't know. I just
driving a truck. Driving a big old truck.
Driving a big old truck.
Rolling down the highway until the break of dawn. Riding a truck with my high heels on.
All right.
All right, I think, bye!
Thank you, Elliot Ridgway, for being part of the show, and we'll
hear
you all again next week. Leave us a voicemail.
503-446-CAST!
Goodbye! Go pee real bad.
Sure.
Don't put that in there, Ben.
No, that's I'm sorry. You said it. It's on the record, buddy.